are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, Czech Books, in which David Vaughan talks to Ondřej Bojar from Charles University about the intricacies of machine translation. After that, a look at a long-forgotten chapter in the history of Prague Castle in Czech history, and finally a Czech lesson with Pavla Horáková. All that coming up, so do please stay with us as we now turn to Czech Books. If you have ever used a computer translation program, you will know what curious things machines can come up with as they try to cope with the complexities and ambiguities of the language we use. So how are machines finding their way through the labyrinth of the Czech language? In this edition of Czech Books, David Vaughan talks to Ondřej Bojar from the Institute of Formal and Applied Linguistics at Prague's Charles University.
When I first started enjoying poetry as a teenager, I remember finding inspiration in William Empson's classic Seven Types of Ambiguity, which explores the wealth of meaning in poetic language. But while we humans might relish the suggestiveness of words, our more rational cousins, the machines, are rather less enthusiastic, and the problems are only magnified when it comes to translating between two such different languages as English and Czech. Ondřej Bojar is part of a team at Charles University trying to polish the science of computer translation into and out of the Czech language. He is the author of Czech and Machine Translation, a summary of the current state of the art of computational linguistics. And the moment you start talking to him, you are left with no doubt at all that Ondřej Bojar is a man who loves his subject.
Machine translation is an intriguing field, which personally I really like because it's touching the human brain and it's what people produce. But the results of human brain are so tangible in linguistics and computational linguistics. You can work with texts, they are written down. So that's why I like this field of study, because I'm interested in how people think and what the mind does and how the mind processes words. Machine translation is one particular application of computational linguistics where you can show whether you have successfully explained to the computer what the meaning is. Machine translation is a quickly evolving field, and due to various reasons, some more obvious and some less obvious, English has been always the main focus of computational linguistics, and so it is with machine translation. So machine translation into English operates much better than machine translation into other languages, and Czech is a beautiful language because of its complexity, and the complexity is in some aspects very different from the complexity observed in English and other languages.
I'd be interested because the complexity of Czech, I should imagine, could in some ways make things more difficult, in other ways make them more easy. More difficult in the sense that it is complex, but more easy in the sense that Czech is a very systematic language, isn't it? It's a grammar-built language where there are very strict rules.
You're definitely right that some things are easier and some things are harder. There's more people who work for English, and therefore the tools and the approaches are more evolved, better fit for the specifics of English. So if so much effort was devoted to Czech, then possibly English would appear more difficult these days.
And so what are these sort of specifics of Czech that make it difficult to find ways of doing reliable machine computer translations?
So it's in short, it's rich morphology. So for English, you have the word cat, and it has two morphological variations, the singular cat and the plural two cats. While for Czech, we have seven cases, four genders, three numbers, and not that each of the different combinations would have a different ending, but still we have many more variants of the word cat. And if you are building a machine translation system and if the system doesn't have a specific component that would be capable of handling this morphology, the system has to learn independently all the morphological variations of the cat. So cat can be translated as kočka, kočko, and it's only the context in the sentence that tells the system which of the cases is appropriate. In the book I have a couple of well-known examples where linguists found funny sentences that have more meanings, more interpretations than they have actually words. So the very famous sentence is ženu holí stroj, and I don't know if we should explain this to our...
I think it's worth explaining, because it's just three words, but it's a sentence that has... Yeah. What, five different meanings or even more?
The first word, ženu, can be either a particular case of the word žena, a woman, or it can be the verb like pushing someone or something or chasing someone or something. Then holí is a highly ambiguous word because of the ending of I. That's a very ambiguous ending in Czech in general. And it can either be a particular case of the word stick, like a walking stick, or it can be the adjective hairless or bald. Then it can be also the verb of shaving. So that was the second word. And the third word in the sentence, stroj, is in its most common reading a machine, but it can also be an imperative, the verb to dress someone up, to put clothes on someone. And actually the endings allow for quite a number of readings for the sentence. So the very same sentence, ženu holí stroj, can either indicate that a woman is being shaved by a machine, that's the most prototypical reading given the word order. Then another meaning could be, I'm chasing a machine with a stick. Another meaning is the imperative of the word stroj, like to dress up. So the meaning of the whole sentence is then dress up the woman with a stick. So use the stick to put the clothes on the woman. And a related but different is a meaning where the stick belongs to the woman in the same sense as we have the Czech translation of the Lord of the Rings. So there is a woman of sticks, and this is the woman that I should dress up. So that's the fourth meaning. And then there's one more meaning, which a colleague of mine found only after the book was printed, that it's the machine of the sticks that I should be chasing. So now I'm sure that all the listeners to the program are completely confused by all the combinations.
And all this, presumably, even for the most sophisticated computer, is just a bit too much, isn't it, at this stage in computer development?
Yeah. The problem is always the ambiguity and the context that disambiguates. And current systems operate at the level of sentences, and it's only slowly becoming the trend that researchers would focus on larger spans than individual sentences. And even within the sentences, the prevailing so-called phrase-based approach to MT actually translates separate phrases independently of the other phrases. So when the system is translating the beginning of the sentence, it doesn't consider the words that appear at the end and vice versa. So current machine translation systems can very easily produce sentences that seem fluent from the beginning till the end, but never contain a verb. So they do not have any meaning for the reader. Or another typical problem of current prevailing MT systems is that the sentence is perfectly fluent, does contain a verb, that's a valid, perfect sentence, except the negation is reversed because the language model was so strong. And instead of saying that someone is a robber, it preferred the reading that was more frequent in the training data and said is not a robber or whatever.
And so you talk about this training data. Is there some way of accumulating a huge corpus of sentences from real life, from real texts out in the real world, that can somehow make the computer more intelligent or more able to kind of think, oh, that's probably saying that, or this context makes me think that this is what this sentence is saying?
The data is essential. So I think almost the only proven approach to improve translation quality is to get more training data. More data is better data. That's it. So
you use this term training data. What actually is that?
So the training data are texts that have been previously translated by humans. For example, the European Union is an excellent institution in this respect. We, as computational linguists, love it because the European institution had the goal, now it's reducing it to some extent, but it had the goal to have all its paperwork in all official languages. And also the fact that people don't like about the European Union, the fact that it regulates everything, is beneficial for us because the vocabulary in those texts is very wide. It describes all the aspects of citizens' lives, so it's good for us.
But it strikes me that you're still a very, very long way away from being able to get a machine that is going to translate reliably from, let's say, from English into Czech in a variety of different fields that we generally tend to read texts in.
If the domain is reasonably narrow, if it's a closed domain, then even current systems can reach near perfect quality.
You mean sort of specialist language in a very particular field?
I mean rather repetitive domain. So if something that worked already in the 70s was the system that translated weather forecasts from English to French or vice versa, and that was perfect because the domain was so restricted.
Czech is a language spoken by only 10 million people, it's surrounded by other languages. The need to translate into Czech and out of Czech is far greater than the number of people who are out there able to keep pace with the need to translate. And do you think that in a few years there really will be sophisticated enough systems, more or less reliably, maybe not at the level of poetry, but at the level of functioning language, to make it much easier to communicate in and out of Czech?
Well, you've mentioned the word reliably, and into English the systems have reached excellent fluency. But the better the fluency is, the higher the risk is that you will not notice a clear error in the meaning. So that's why I would actually be more and more cautious as the systems evolve.
So it's going to be a long time before air traffic controllers start using machine translation.
I hope they never will. Personally, I think that computers or robots will have no chance of understanding our language without actually walking with us in the streets and having similar problems as we have, like buying the food and preparing dinners. Only when the robots will start living with us, they can be trained to understand us in the real meaning of that word.
And is that just sci-fi, or could it happen?
I think it could happen.
André Boyard, thank you very much indeed, and best of luck with your future research.
Thanks a lot for inviting me to talk to you.
And finally, in case you're wondering why André says that there are four genders in Czech, normally you'd just expect feminine, masculine and neuter, the reason is that there are two types of masculine nouns, animate and inanimate. Grammatically, they behave quite differently. Such are the joys of Czech.
André Boyard from the Institute of Formal and Applied Linguistics at Prague's Charles University, talking there to Radio Prague's David Vaughan. A reminder that you're with the International Service of Czech Radio, where we now turn to one of the country's symbols. You'd be hard to find a visitor to Prague who has not been to Prague Castle. But it was not always that way. In this edition of Czech History, Jan Richter looks at Prague Castle's forgotten era.
Prague Castle is considered one of the symbols of the Czech state. Once the seat of Bohemian kings, it now houses the office of the Czech president, and its museums and galleries annually attract millions of visitors. But for over 100 years, Prague Castle was half forgotten. With the imperial court residing in Vienna throughout the 19th century, the castle only served as a luxurious hotel for the royal family and their relatives and friends. A recently published book of memoirs entitled A Greeting from the Castle Hill now offers an insider's look into those times. In this edition of Czech History, I discuss the book with one of its editors, Martin Halata from Prague Castle Archives.
All the history of the 19th century of the castle is slightly hidden. So that's why I decided to show how the castle was and how was the history of the castle in the 19th century.
Well, in the 19th century, Prague Castle was an interesting place. You say it was hidden. Because, of course, the ruling family, the court, no longer resided in Prague because it was based in Vienna. So what was Prague Castle used for? What function did it have?
Well, the Prague Castle was one of the 19 houses belonged to the royal family. So it was in the Habsburg language or in the court language, it was called Administration, or to be exact, Absteig Administration, a house which was used for living of the royal family when they was present in Prague in Bohemia, in the Kingdom of Bohemia. And it was quite common in all European countries that the royal families have a lot of houses used for like hotel, to be exact.
From the memoirs, it does sound like it was some kind of upscale hostel for either the Habsburg royal family or for their relatives and friends, because the man is describing all kinds of visits. For instance, somebody from Italy was here, I think, running away from plague. What was the most common sort of purpose? Why did these people, these royal families and their relatives, why did they usually come?
They come either for important moments, like for coronation, for burials, for some church festivities or so, or they escape from the main seat because of illness, like cholera and so on, or because of war in European history. So when they need to be out of the main seat, they use the Prague Castle like their house for survive some such moments, critical moments.
There was one figure, which was the Emperor Ferdinand V. He resigned in 1848, letting Franz Joseph I take over. And then he spent the rest of his life, basically, in Prague Castle. What did he do here?
Well, Ferdinand I, the fifth, is a different person in all the Habsburg family. Because he was under pension, so he has private in a Habsburg language casa, so it was quite well to do. So the reason was to spend the rest of his life in good circumstances. So not only Prague Castle, but as well Ploskovice and Zákupy castles in the North Bohemia, Ploškovice und Reichstadt. And so the main reason was to spend the rest of his life in the good circumstances. And what he did here on the Prague Castle, not much. He promoted Bohemian musings, Smetana, Škroup, and all days were in, let's say, social living and so on.
Was there any under Habsburg who would normally live in Vienna but liked coming to Prague and thought, you know, Prague was his favorite place to come? Or?
Well, I think not in the 19th century. Before, of course, it was Earl II and Leopold. Just these three Habsburg personalities enjoyed Prague Castle.
So what was life like for the boy, really? Because the mid-19th century is described from the viewpoint of a boy, of the son of the inspector. How do you think he thought of growing up at Prague Castle?
Well, the circumstances were quite attractive. It was a quite noble house. So they have, or the boy has opportunity to be in touch with either royal family or with the noble families which were close to the real royal family. So they have been quite privileged. Imagine all day spending in either in dome or in the royal castle. So it was different from usual boy's life.
Was it empty, the building? Today, of course, it houses the president's office, the archive, the museums and galleries. What was here besides those families living here, the employees of the administration, was it empty?
On one hand, it was quite empty. and the house have been alive when the court came to live here. On the other hand, it was quite normal, let's say, a house, and it's been necessary to care about it. So they care in daily life about gardens, about roofs, about horses in the stables and so on. So maybe it was much more lively than today.
In one point he describes how he was looking forward to, they got the news basically that some relatives of the royal family were coming again. And he's very happy because castle fills with people. He says all the bars, all the iron bars go up and the doors open and people come again. And he says when at times when, you know, no such royal visit is staying in the castle, that only really few people from the city come here, usually, you know, religious people who come for the cathedral. Was the castle open at the time, the public, so to speak? Could people just come and you know, walk around?
It was. Anyway, the Prague castle was so-called Prague castle district. So the district was closed after 9 p.m. and open at, let's say, 8 in the morning. But during this time, it was open for the public, of course. It was, let's say, small city, very special small city with traffic, with small shops and so on. And even the royal garden was open for public, but not for free. The visitors have to buy tickets to enter the royal garden.
How was Prague Castle different at the time, in mid-19th century? Of course, if you sort of leave aside the function it has today and it had back then, but was it very different architecturally?
From nowadays, not. It was, well, all you can see today, it's almost like in the 19th century. Of course, a very big difference became in the, let's say, 1925, when our first Republic president, Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, started to rebuild castle like Demokratický hrad, like democratic castle. So they changed gardens, József Plečník changed gardens for new purpose. The courts have been rebuilt for new Republican ceremony and so on and so on. But to be exact, not very much has been Prague Castle changed from the 19th century.
Was it also for commercial use? I mean, could people, businessmen or whoever, could they rent rooms or some section of the castle in the 19th century from the royal family, or was it exclusively for the visitors that are invited? Or?
It was quite difficult, but, for example, they used Vladislavský sál, the Huldigungssaal, for, let's say, somehow workshop. So, for example, the Academy of Fine Arts have been in use, Vladislavský sál, for their courses in paintings and drawings. And so that's all I know about so-called commercial in use of the Prague Castle.
People still live in the very building of the Prague Castle today. Of course, there are employees of the office of the president. One of the previous employees, Mr. Jakl, who left with, of course, the previous president, Václav Klaus, he recently said he was looking forward to leaving his apartment up in the Prague Castle because it was a nice view, but it was kind of too distant. He said, you know, there are no services nowadays in the area. You have to go everywhere. How do you feel working here? And would you like to live in Prague Castle as well?
Well, maybe living in 19th century was attractive here on the castle because you have been in a circle of quite perfect services for the Habsburg court. So you have here a lot of kitchens, the personnel who cares about you to live here. But now it's quite different. Now it's really a house for presidential office. So that's the difference.
Oh. That edition of Czech History by Jan Richter was first aired in August of last year. And now in the remaining few minutes, our weekly Czech lesson for those of you who are interested in the Czech language. This week, Pavla Horáková will teach you how to say, I haven't a clue.
Dítě školou povinné dovede to, co mine. My jsme sice světa znalí, my jsme lidé s rozhledem, ale hráč si jako malý to bohužel nesvedem.
Welcome to another edition of Sound Czech, where you can learn Czech words and idioms through song lyrics. The expression to listen out for today is nemá ani šajna, which is a colloquial way to say that someone doesn't have a clue. The title of the song is Dítě školou povinné, or School Child, and it was written by the 1960s legendary Czech duo Jiří Suchý and Jiří Šlipy.
O takové věci domovní důvěrnice nemá ani šajna.
The song speaks about the wild imagination of children. For example, children can see animals in ordinary pieces of furniture, or they can conjure up a secret passage leading from their house to the street, which is something the caretaker doesn't have a clue about. Nemá ani šajna. Listen again.
Nemá ani šajna.
The simpler way to say nemám ani šajna would of course be nevím, I don't know. You can also say nemám tušení, I don't have an inkling. Or nemám zdání, I don't have the slightest idea. Or even nemám páru, literally, I don't have steam, but again meaning, I don't have any idea.
Dítě školou povinné, dovede to, co mine. My jsme sice světa znalí, my jsme lidé s rozhledem, ale hráč si jako malý to bohužel nesvedem.
Besides nemá ani šajna, there are other interesting expressions in the song, such as the title itself. Dítě školou povinné is literally a child having the duty to attend school, or simply a school child. The expression lidé světa znalí is a similar grammatical construction, meaning people who know the ways of the world.
Dítě školou povinné dovede to, co mine. My jsme sice světa znalí, my jsme lidé s rozhledem, ale hráč si jako malý to bohužel nesvedem.
So today we have learned the expressions dítě školou povinné, a school child, lidé světa znalí, people knowing the ways of the world, and nemá ani šajna, he or she doesn't have a clue. All three can be found in a single song by Jiří Suchý and Jiří Šlitr, the legendary hitmakers of the golden 1960s. Until next time, naschledanou.
Když si dítě zamane, kuchyně se stane lesem, što krdlem medvědem, já i vy to těžce nesem, že to taky nesvedem.
Dítě věří tomu, že z domu do ulice vede třeba chodba, ajá. O takové věci domovní důvěrnice nemá ani šajna, ajá.
Dítě školou povinné dovede to, co mine. Dejme tomu v elektrice, v průnočí se rozplyne. Dítě blomá po Africe, loví více a mine.
And I'm afraid that edition of Soundcheck brings us to the end of today's program from Prague. You'll find us online at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then please write to english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you, as always. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today and enjoy your weekend.